Your Money Replay from Money FM 89.3. Money and Me on Your Money, only on Money FM 89.3.
This is Money and Me. We are broadcasting live from Arena One at B2. Come and join us. We're just across Starbucks. So great to have you with us today. We're talking to Arun Pai, Chief Crystals Officer at Crystal AI, to digest all the big business headlines. How are you, Arun?
Very good. Thank you so much for having me,
Thank you for coming by. It's such a joy to have you with us. So big news in the Business Times today. I want to start with that headline that MAS is looking into regulating the trading of payment token derivatives. What does this mean for the retail investor?
Sure. So let's begin with splitting up what exactly a token is versus a cryptocurrency.
Yes.
So cryptocurrencies are stuff like, you know, Bitcoin is the big one, where you have a lot of, you know, the currency or the cryptocurrency went up all the way to like $20,000, came crashing down to $7,000, and now is like rallied back up to like close to $9,000 or $9,500. So you can see crazy amounts of volatility in something that is supposed to be extremely secure, and for that matter, some investors were actually comparing it to gold. Wow. So you have cryptocurrencies on one side, and on the other side, you have this thing called tokens. Tokens are nothing but, think of it like equities or bonds, an asset class that is basically tradable on blockchain technology. So a private company can issue an ICO, an initial coin offering, which is nothing but a token or some kind of value that is derived from its underlying business. Mm-hmm. So you have cryptocurrencies that are tradable like currencies. When you're buying, say, Aussie dollar or GBP or something, you're sitting and buying and selling Bitcoin because the underlying value is a currency, or you think of it as a currency. On the other hand, a token is something that derives its value from an underlying business, which is an ICO. Now, what MAS has basically come out with is saying, you know what, let's allow approved exchanges to be able to trade derivatives of Bitcoin. Now we're going into a little bit of a personal view over here. I kind of side with Warren Buffett and Charlie Munger, where cryptocurrencies itself are extremely dangerous and risky to the average investor, not just the average investor, but even the smarter, quote-unquote, ones. Volatility is through the roof, and it's something to be extremely cautious about. Now, on top of that, you're going to be allowing derivatives, which is a leveraged play, which is your options like calls or puts or CFDs for people who are more familiar with the Singapore stock market. Mm-hmm. The regulator is kind of giving an okay for that to take place, for that trading to take place on approved exchanges here. It's something to be extremely, extremely cautious about. So let's see what eventually happens. But last thing we want is something like a repeat of 2008, where all these derivatives and stable underlying, such as housing mortgages, kind of crashed the entire economy. Now you're sitting and having derivatives on extremely volatile underlyings like Bitcoin and Ether. And
Got
so
it.
Time will tell.
So if it is allowed, would these derivatives help retail investors hedge their exposure to cryptocurrencies?
If used in the right manner, then absolutely yes. Let's take a look at foreign exchange derivatives, right? This is something that's been actively used in exchanges and by corporates extensively for the past 50 years. You have an underlying cash flow or underlying currency that a corporate is exposed to. You can sit and do forwards, you can sit and do options to try and mitigate your risk. But the problem is, human nature being what it is, we are extremely greedy. So it stops going from something to try and mitigate your risk, which options and derivatives are extremely useful for, going into trying to enhance your leverage and trying to achieve outsized returns. But the problem with outsized returns is you can have potentially outsized losses, and that's why you see most of your retail FX-friendly platforms, you actually see most retail customers going bankrupt on that, doing leveraged foreign exchange trades.
One more question in this area, and then we'll move on. Arun Pai is Chief Crystals Officer at Crystal AI, one of my favorite commentators to speak to on this show, Money and Me, where financial literacy and education is at the heart of everything that we do. So if we look at MAS derivatives of payment tokens, for the retail investor, you talked about the value of these payment tokens being derived from their business. Do you think it's still a little ambiguous where the value of these derivatives rest on?
Sure. So it is a bit complicated. Like buying a token itself, unlike when you buy an equity, like a share or an equity of a business, you know that you're taking a certain ownership of the business. The way tokens are mostly structured is it's you're not actually buying a certain percentage of the underlying business. You have to actually go through the 100, 200 page document to see for that specific token, what exactly are you buying? Are you buying a certain percentage of revenues of the company? Are you getting a certain percentage of profit of the business? It's very different from you are actually buying the business.
Right.
Now, derivatives on top of that makes it another layer above that where it starts getting to be a lot more murkier. I believe the derivatives that are being talked about in the paper is more along the lines of cryptocurrencies,
correct,
which is Bitcoin and Ether,
yes,
and not ICOs. So, for example, you have a derivative for DBS shares. So you buy an equity, you buy a DBS share, you can trade a derivative, a call or a put option on top of that. Now, on the other hand, in this specific case, you have Bitcoin, which is the equivalent to, say, like Aussie dollar or GBP or US dollar, mm-hmm, and you have a derivative on top of that. I don't think we are going down the route of derivatives on ICOs or tokens currently. It's a derivative on the equivalent of a bit of a currency, of a cryptocurrency, which is like Bitcoin.
Get it. Okay, that's really clear. Let's move on to our next topic, the business story that will not go away, U.S. and China. The U.S. has issued a 90-day extension for U.S. suppliers to do business with Chinese tech giant Huawei. U.S.-China trade talks limping along. The U.S. continues to emphasize that this is an issue of national security, U.S. suppliers dealing with Chinese tech giants, that is. Huawei has been added to the U.S. Commerce Department's entity list earlier this year, May. The tech giant saying this addition will hurt the U.S. more than it will China. So, okay, another 90-day extension. Both sides, U.S., China, cannot come to an agreement in their trade talks. But what do you think that this extension for U.S. businesses really means?
I mean, thank God that the extension took place, right? Because otherwise, the trade war discussions right now would be playing on a whole other playing field. But that being said, it became 90 days, but Trump was actually shooting for it to be 14 days. It's an ever-evolving news. If you look just last night, Dow Jones dropped like 200 points, then rallied a little bit to 100 points because this trade war discussion or the signing of the agreement, reports or rumors had it that it was not going to be done in this calendar year. And now if it's not being done in this calendar year, you never know what are going to happen to the bigger round of tariffs that are going to be potentially a lot more painful to consumers. That'll take place in December on the consumer electronics space. If the two counterparties, China and the US, can't come to some kind of an agreement relatively soon, the bigger question is, what will happen to the big round of tariffs that companies across the board in all of their earnings call have said that if the December tariffs go through, it will be a massive effect to the US consumer. And the US consumer is the one that's kind of like saving the world economy to some extent right now.
I think I'm single-handedly doing that with my midnight shopping, actually, Arun.
And that.
There are more than 200 requests by U.S. companies who want to continue their business with Huawei. The Commerce Department over in the U.S. could grant individual licenses for these companies. How likely do you see the U.S. being willing to meet these requests of, you know, their own companies?
Excellent question. And it's all a big bit of a chicken and egg situation right now, right? They're just, it seems like the U.S. is just stringing along Huawei, because if the 90-day reprieve had not taken place, then you know that China would have really unleashed any kind of measures that it potentially can,
sure,
to try and hurt the U.S. back. But on the flip side, more than the 200 companies that are on the wait list right now to try and supply Huawei important integral machinery and stuff, the no green light has been given by the Commerce Department. So you're in the situation where a reprieve has taken place for 90 days, but at the same time, not all businesses can supply Huawei with integral equipment for their 5G space. The U.S. is obviously trying to play this in an extremely smart way, where they'll only agree to enabling all its local companies to supply Huawei with all sorts of hardware equipment only if China kind of like bows down to its knees. But then on the other hand, you have China that's waiting to see how this impeachment trial will take place. It's trying to see what the bill that got passed yesterday, yep, with the Senate and the House basically saying, we're on the side of Hong Kong on this one. China, you basically need to stop what you're doing. And China has very unequivocally said, we do not want any external pressure or involvement of any company or country in our local domestic affairs. And Hong Kong is obviously a domestic affair.
Absolutely. Yeah. What a tangled web we weave. We'll be back to that story in no time. But now I want to move on to WeWork. They have plans to cut at least 4,000 employees. So WeWork is a workplace provider, and they're going to cut these jobs because it's trying to stabilize itself from breakneck growth. It caused heavy losses. WeWork leases office space from landlords, and it shelved plans for an IPO in September. You may remember that. Investors were put off by the company's losses. There were questions about corporate governance swirling all over the place. Adding to the list of troubles, the New York State Attorney General is investigating founder and former chief executive Adam Neumann about whether he was self-dealing to enrich himself. So we've talked about WeWork before, Arun, but is there something about the business model that is inherently flawed in your opinion?
I'm surprised you didn't use the mention the word tech when you were trying to describe WeWork, because this is a retail company that kind of mentioned the word technology something like 179 times in their last annual report
confusing
release.
Confusing people. What are you, a landlord or a fintech? What do you do?
Excellent point. It's strange. Like the business model, it's an age-old, a century-old business model. And by placing the word technology in it a bunch of times and having like a really cool app where you can like book meetings within the space does not make you a technology company.
Well said.
Yet it wanted to try and garner technology company type revenue and earnings multiples. Well, not earnings, I would say, but just valuations. And leading it to come close to like $50 billion at one point of time. Corporate governance, obviously a massive question mark.
Mm.
What Adam basically did was he trademarked the name We, then convinced his company to try and change its name to We, and thereby paying him $6 million in the process. And he had to actually give back that $6 million, obviously, once it became public. But that's just like one instance in a whole host of issues that have massive corporate governance concerns in the company. But taking a step back, I think it's an interesting issue where you have a lot of these startup or private companies that have basically been funded by insane amounts, millions, if in some cases, if not billions of dollars, that have led to a crazy exponential growth in valuations and a lot of question marks being left behind on whether this business model is sustainable or not. So let's start from the beginning, right? You have investors who are very concerned about the volatility in the public market space because on a day-to-day basis, you are mark to market, say Microsoft or DBS or Google goes up or down 1%, your portfolio gets affected and it's reflected in your bank statement or your fund statement. On the other hand, investors realizing that, you know, volatility is going to start creeping back into the markets, they're a little bit more afraid. What do they go out and do? They're like, okay, you know what? I'll take all my money and put it into private funds because I'm not going to be affected by the mark-to-market as much because this is only like a monthly, if not quarterly, NAV or net asset value stamp. So you have private investors who have now received this millions or billions of dollars from investors. What do they have to go about doing? They can only start charging fees on this money only once they start deploying that asset.
Right.
So, you know, these large private equity companies or venture capital companies, you mentioned it comes in the headlines that, oh, they've raised $300 million, they've raised $3 billion. But they actually don't start earning fees on that. They only start earning fees on it once that capital has actually been deployed or invested into a company. Then their incentives are such that, you know, I've accumulated so much money, what do? I need to start spending it immediately. And there was no greater example of that than the Vision Fund of SoftBank that raised $100 billion in a venture capital space that had never, ever seen this kind of a size of a fund involved in the industry. They came along and they started just spraying cash across a whole host of companies, such as WeWork, led to really inflated valuations. We've talked about the venture capital fund or the private equity fund that's kind of feeding this bubble. And then obviously you have your startups, like your WeWork, like many other startup companies, that have now gotten all this capital, and they're kind of feigning an actual workable business model to just receiving all this capital from VCs, spending it to acquire customers at any cost that's possible, providing a free service, and showing that hockey stick growth. In the case of Singaporeans, when Uber and Grab were fighting it out in this country, it was great for consumers. right? Yes. Where we sat, you obviously download both the apps, which one is giving you a completely free ride or a highly subsidized ride, and you'd pick that.
Sure.
The problem is, it looks great for a certain period of time, until if you can get to a stage where that company can become some kind of a monopoly, which all these startups have basically used Amazon as their poster boy to justify its business model. You lose billions of dollars for years and years, and then you know you'll become the next Jeff Bezos, and you'll come up with like this great company called Amazon. Sadly, you have like millions of companies that actually die before you even get to that stage. So it's a big flywheel right now that's spinning very quickly in the direction of a benefit to consumers presently. But what will happen in the long run when this capital eventually dries out, which it always does? You always are through cycles. Capital always does dry up. What will happen at the end of the day to the consumer at that point of time?
Fantastic. I could listen to Arun Pai for 4 hours straight, really. Don't worry, I won't put you behind the mic for that long. He's Chief Crystals Officer at Crystal AI. He leads investment, and we are talking to him about some of the biggest business headlines this morning. You're on Money FM 89.3, broadcasting live from Marina Bay. B2, come on down and join us. So we talked about SoftBank a while ago. They're such an integral part of the WeWork rescue story, so to speak. But if you look at SoftBank itself, SoftBank's Yahoo Japan discussing a merger with messaging app operator LINE. This in a move to expand the Japanese conglomerate's e-commerce and payment services. Yahoo Japan is known as Z Holdings. Stay with me. A lot of differing names here. But as Z Holdings says, discussions are ongoing. Nothing's been finalized with LINE. SoftBank owns almost 50% of Z Holdings. So what conditions contributed to SoftBank wanting to merge with LINE?
I think Masa-san is stuck. The CEO of SoftBank is stuck in a very hard place, right? He's come out with all these grandiose statements of a 300-year vision for the company. He's talked about how his Vision Fund 1, which accumulated $100 billion, is going to become, you know, one of the most successful private investment vehicles that the universe has seen till this date, and that Vision Fund 2 is going to be an even larger, even bigger monster in the space. But after the debacle that was Uber's failed IPO, WeWork's near collapse, and all sorts of other headlines in the pet grooming space, and a number of other really large investments that Vision Fund has made have not proven to be as successful, SoftBank kind of needed a quick win. And the best way, or one of the easiest ways, quote unquote, to have a quick win is to try and form a monopoly, because then you can basically eventually charge customers, or you have a full control of the customer base in a certain jurisdiction or geographical area, and you can potentially start charging them a little bit more money in the future, thereby making a little bit more profit. So what you had in Japan are basically like two of the largest QR code payment companies, and obviously SoftBank currently at least is flush with a bunch of cash, and they decided, you know what, let's merge top number one and number two. We'll get to something like 164 million LINE users currently, merge them with our user base from the largest QR code payment company in Japan, while using the excuse of foreign incumbents, like people from the US, payment companies from the US and China are trying to encroach on our home territory. Let's create this massive behemoth, and we'll be able to, you know, form a monopoly and hopefully become profitable, or a lot more profitable in the future. So this was one of a quick wins that hopefully the SoftBank can achieve. The share price is obviously down something like 20-25% from the highs post WeWork and Uber's failed IPO, as well as, you know, post IPO share prices coming down. So something to be quite concerned about. SoftBank is obviously running a little bit afraid right now and trying to go for the quicker win, I feel.
Okay, before I let you go, Arun, speaking of IPO, let's talk about the Saudi Aramco IPO. The world's largest oil company, Saudi Aramco, looking to pull off its IPO in just 3 days after launching a deal. This according to our sources. Aramco looking to sell 1.5% of its shares, or about 3 billion shares, at a price range of 30 to 32 riyals. So that gives the IPO a valuation of as much as 96 billion riyals. Do you think that the IPO will be pulled off?
Yeah, so it was kind of like what we discussed last week, right? Where they're doing a smart thing, go into or do a partial IPO in a very closed exchange in a way, which is their local exchange, by convincing a bunch of really rich, the royal families, other rich institutional investors, to try and pump up the valuation as high as possible, which might not potentially have been possible if they do it in more established open exchanges like the US, Hong Kong, or the UK. So they came out, they are achieving a valuation of something close to 1.7 trillion US dollars, which is on the higher end spectrum of what they were hoping. You know, the range was really wide previously, which was anywhere from 1 trillion to 2 trillion US dollars. They've gotten something on the higher spectrum. They've achieved kind of what they had to set out to achieve from this round, but investors in the globe are very smart. While they will potentially use this as some kind of a benchmark, I think the true test will be when they go for the secondary offering, which is in these global exchanges, which is for a larger amount, the 3 to 5% potentially, issuing the outstanding shares of the company. Once that happens, then I think we'll get a much better color of what the true valuation of the company is. The biggest people who lost out because of this, though, are your Western investment banks, who were hoping to gain something like close to $300 to $500 million in IPO fees if Aramco had gone about trying to do this whole global worldwide offering. But keeping it local, they could keep their costs down, at least get some kind of a benchmark for their valuation, be it a somewhat fake valuation, but at the end of the day, it is what it is.
Always a joy speaking to you. Thank you so much for helping us digest the biggest headlines this morning. He's Arun Pai, Chief Crystals Officer at Crystal AI.
Before acting on the information on Money FM, please consider if it's suitable for your own investment objectives, financial situation, and risk tolerance. To listen to more great interviews, download our podcasts at moneyfm893.sg or download the SPH radio app available on Google Play or the App Store.